Hello.
Hello. This is David.
Hi, Darren. You have Louise and Jim.
Okay, Todd's not joining us, or is he going to call in later?
He is, but it's only 1 minute after the time, so let's give him a second.
Okay. You want to wait for him or what?
I'm here.
Hey, Todd. How you doing?
Hi, Todd.
Hello.
Okay.
We're all here.
Okay, so let me ask you, I got your comments, and I did look up the references in that you referred to in that the UK's rules. Let me ask you all, it's been about a month since this ruling came out. Have you all had a chance to read it?
Yes.
And digest it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So let me ask you this. Before we get into the, what the options are here, I was, had a lot of time to kind of digest this and contemplate what happened here. And as you all remember, when I first contacted George and, before we even got involved in this with the funder, we had due diligence done. I forget the law firm that researched the case to determine the probability of winning, but I think the funder paid for that, and based upon the ruling they got back, they decided to fund the case. And then also based upon that ruling, Vincent and Elkins decided to participate in it too. So, there was a high probability right from the beginning from both the funder's part and the Vincent Elkins part that this was winnable. And consequently, millions of dollars were put into this case by the funder and also Vincent and Elkins. And so I guess my question is, everybody thought, including the firm that did the research, your firm, VE, the funder, that the facts and evidence were on our side. We had a good case. So my question is, have you done any analysis from your end of why we lost this case?
Well, yeah, I think we all have asked ourselves that question.
Did you come up with an answer?
I think we all have our own answers.
Well, let's start with you, Jim. What is your answer? What do you think happened?
Well, I want to make a preparatory statement, though.
All right.
There is no case out there in the commercial world that I've ever encountered about which it could be said, the chances of success in this case are, 100%, or really even 80%. I have consistently throughout my career refused to attempt to remove human error and human judgment from the equation, because you can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it is a correct statement that all the law firms that looked at it on our side of the case believed, and I think correctly, I don't find any flaw in the analysis, that the case was meritorious, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, not only did you believe that, Jim, and not only did the funder believe that, but you believed it so much that you put in millions of dollars into this case, and the funder did too. I know that you between you and the funder, there's, $10 million lost in this case? With you?
That much, but it's a lot of money. I'll put it this way:
it's a lot of money. All right. So you not only believed it, but you put your money where your beliefs are. Believing is one thing. I can believe that you know, maybe Jesus will come back next year. But, you know, when you believe something where you put your money on the table, that's a solid conviction more than just a belief, right?
Well, yeah, we acted on the belief. I don't want to get into the metaphysics of it, but yes, you're correct.
Well, no, it's not. I don't mean metaphysical. I think you can believe in anything. I can believe on, you know, the sun coming up tomorrow or whatever, or you know, whatever you can, you know, people. Well, you know, look, in the UK, they bet on everything, right? I mean, they have bets that you can place on anything. So, this was a bet. This was a huge bet that the funder put in on this case, and your firm put on this case, and. You know, you had more than a belief that it was in. You had a very high probability conviction that this could be winnable. So when you have all the facts and evidence, when you have this kind of, conviction by the lawyers and by the funders, and then you lose, then you have to have some serious questions why that happened. Okay, and I've been asking those questions too. Louise, you have anything to say about that? Do you have any, you know, thoughts on that?
Well, let me give you the answer to your question.
Go ahead.
All right. The root cause of this, in my view, and I think there's more than one cause. I think the root cause of this is that the tribunal decided that this was an environmental matter, and they were not going to second-guess environmental regulation, and that the losses incurred by the investors were at least in part attributable to their own failure to do due diligence properly, and that they simply were not willing to second guess what Costa Rica was saying about its own processes. And they were saying, well, this is just a risk inherent in doing development, and you weren't exposed to any risk greater than anybody in Costa Rica would have been involved, would have been exposed to, who had invested in this. And therefore, we just don't find any sort of discriminatory animus against the foreign investors that justify holding Costa Rica responsible on an international plane. It doesn't necessarily
All right. Well, okay. So, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Let me finish.
Yeah.
So, I don't believe that is correct. I believe that there are some significant errors in judgment being made there. And, you know, as God sees it, were they simply lacking courage? Did they make an honest mistake? Did they have some personal animus against you or the investors as a group or personal affinity for Costa Rica? I don't know. Mm-hmm. But I want to be careful not to get into motives. I think we can all agree that they're wrong in the way the conclusions they drew from the evidence. But I think that to the extent that there was a thumb on their jurisprudential scale, it was, this is an environmental matter, and I don't want to be the guy that invalidates a state's otherwise legitimate environmental regulation. I'd be interested to hear what Todd and Louise think about this.
All right, go ahead. I'm listening. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Louise, you want to go first? Go ahead.
Sure. I mean, so Jim and I have not discussed our separate views before this. And I mean, I have to say my feeling reading the award was exactly that. And so that the arbitrators were not willing to sort of look behind the environmental decision. But also what I think permeated the award was a sense that they had that there was a lack of care or due diligence on the part of the investors. Now, however unfair that may sort of feel or seem or unjustified, I think they really read a lot into the fact that, you know, we were not able to produce certain evidence, for example, the construction permits for easement 7 and 8. and that we hadn't shown them the Prati report. Now, I know everything we say about the Prati report, but I do think that some of those things sort of affected the way they viewed the investors' due diligence overall. And I think that played into their view of the risks that the investors assumed in investing in Costa Rica and the otherwise legitimate environmental regulations that Costa Rica was apparently enforcing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Todd?
I'm in the same ballpark as you know. I've already told you my opinion and it hasn't changed. I think that there's something about Costa Rica and environmental issues that, I mean, this is the second time I've lost a case I thought I should win. And in both cases, I just think that they interpreted the law wrong, the domestic law wrong. And here, the one thing they had to do, even if everything else was the same, the way Louise just described it, that they basically decided that they could blame the investors for not having done a better job of informing Cetena and not getting better counsel or advice. The problem with that is that just still doesn't get them anywhere unless they misconstrue the law. And they misconstrued it by putting all of the onus on you rather than on Cetena. And that, to me, makes no sense because Cetena is the one that's supposed to, under the law, that's supposed to make the decision as to what is or what isn't wetlands. It did that. Whether or not you gave them the so-called Prati report shouldn't have changed anything. So I think that they had to make a finding that was wrong about Costa Rican law. And I think it's a travesty that they did that, given that Costa Rica didn't even bother having Cetena people there. Though they did have enough for the tribunal to at least theoretically make the decision, because they had like an attorney general person there. And so they have enough to cover their asses on that. But I think they made that's sort of the key right down to an issue, is that they misinterpreted Cetena's role and they gave Costa Rica a pass, and I think that they blamed the investors, and it was too easy for them to do it. But again, just blaming the investors isn't enough. They had to also misconstrue the law that was here. And the sad thing is that this is both tribunals I've had did ultimately the same thing, which was misconstrue the law, believing what Costa Rica told them that it said, rather than actually deciding what it really said.
Okay, but to be fair with you, Todd, in that case you lost. I think you lost it on jurisdictional grounds because it wasn't filed in time. It was sometime there was a time issue under the treaty, right? That you lost.
Yeah, but that rolled into the timing issue rolled into the nature of the law. So in that case, it was they invested when the law said X, and the tribunal ignored the fact that the law said X. I guess I should explain what X is. It basically, the law said, we declare this area a park, and you can use it however you have been using it. Go right ahead. You retain all your rights, but it's a park now. Mm-hmm. And yet the tribunal, despite that fact, and despite the fact that only half of the area involved in the case was part of that declaration, they nonetheless misconstrued the law to apply to the whole area, and also they missed the part where it said that they were allowed to exercise their rights even though it was a park. And it's the timing fits into when they invested and under what the rules were when they invested. So yes, in both cases they had to misconstrue the law to make their argument work. In the other case, it was misconstrue the law so that the timing was off. And in your case, it was misconstrue the law so they could blame the investors for not having gotten whatever mythical better advice they should have gotten.
Okay, so, well, I still think, you know, I don't know. I'll have to read that again, but I'm not going to, you know more about it than I do. But I thought it was because the CAFTA treaty, was it in play? It was before the CAFTA treaty? was enacted in 2009 or something. I don't know. But anyway, let me just say this, that the commonality between your case and that Ugebe case, that German, when they... Yeah, the Germans won $4 million for Costa Rica not giving them a permit to build a bed and breakfast. They didn't even have a permit, but they asserted that and were upheld that the same thing, environmental things, right? That case was an environmental issue too. That it was an environmentally sensitive.
It was the same
right?
facts, just a different timing for the of the investors. But Unglob was the Reinhardt was the same. He was a neighbor of my guys.
Yeah. Okay. So, but it was still involved the environmental thing. So, and they didn't even have a they didn't even have a permit. They wouldn't give them a permit. But they won that case. Our case.
Didn't really, but they didn't win much of it. They won like. But they did win. They got money.
They got a win. They got $4 million. They probably didn't make any money on it, but they did get a win. But in our case, all the permits were issued, right? We had all the permits. And there was not only one Sitena resolution. There was six Sitena resolutions. And did we – and I don't want to get into this now, but this theory – that we did something where we hid something from the see that started from Lacey. They came up with that as a strategy to get around the fact that we had all the permits. So what did they do? They come up with a strategy that I duped them. I concealed the wetlands from them, right? So
that's where they made a big deal about the Prati report.
We they made a big deal about it. We should have made a big deal about it. All right. We didn't make enough of a big deal about it that was a nonsense report and it had nothing to do with wetlands. It didn't say there was wetlands there at all. That Prati report was done by a third party, in conjunction with soil tests they were doing for the infrastructure. It wasn't ordered by me or Musio. It was ordered by Tecmet Control, I believe, who was doing the infrastructure work, and they wanted soil tests done so they could come up with the infrastructure plans. But of course, we didn't argue it properly or strong aggressively, and so they bought into it. Now, when he made that duping statement, I told George, I said, listen, I'm not going to stand for that slander. And to me, when he made that statement, opening statement, George should have been jumping up on his feet and says, listen, that is hearsay evidence. Mr. Avon didn't dupe anybody, and I want to instruct the panel to tell them to quit making those slanderous and defaming statements, because there's no evidence anywhere that Mr. Avon duped anybody. But there's no objection.
It wasn't actually. It wasn't actually hearsay evidence. It was just. It was worse than that.
Okay. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Well, go ahead. What was it?
You're not allowed to. You're not allowed to interrupt the other guy's opening statement.
Listen. Look. All right. Okay. I don't want to get into that right now. But anyway. Look. You know, and I rejected that. I rejected that, categorically denied it. I said, I got to have an opportunity before he starts cross-examining me to deny that, because that's an offense. Do you know what they did? They accused me of being a criminal in defrauding a government. That's a very serious crime. And obviously, nobody cared about it. All right? But they jumped on it. And they continued to jump on it, and I categorically denied it. And what did I say? What did I say in my statement? I said, I didn't dupe anybody. Where is the Sitena statement saying I duped them? All right. Now, here's the big fallacy and big problem with this case. They failed to produce all their key witnesses from Satana, Manai, Sinek, Inta, Krishna Bogantis, Picardo, all the key people, just hid them. All right. Now, what's that do to the rule of law? The rule of law says, and I'm going to talk about what the rules of evidence were, but the rule of law, I think, customary international law is that, listen, if you're accused, the accused has a right to face their accuser in court. You can't have somebody saying, oh, by the way, Satena said this. By the way, this is what Satena thought. This is what Manai thought. This is what Inta says. All through the hearing were these comments about Satena, Manai, Sinek, Inta, Krishna Bogantis, all right? And they're nowhere to be found. And that's the abomination of this case. That's where this went off the rails. And to me, there was just no forceful objection to that ever. You know what he said about that? Here's what he said about it. Instead of screaming about it, he said, "Well, I would like the arbitrators to take note that the key witnesses aren't here." Do you think that's sufficient? No, I don't. And neither did the tribunal think it was sufficient.
I mean, one, we do address that in our papers. That is not the only thing that he said. And two, you know...
But I was there. Look, I was there. I heard what he said, okay? I heard what he said.
I read it, too. And, you know, I doubt very seriously that making something louder or more forcefully would have changed their view. I mean, in some ways, it would have been worse because it just draws attention to it.
Well, those are...
I understand why you're right to be upset about it. I'm not trying to talk you out of that. I'm just saying that these arbitrators, where they were mentally on this, was not very receptive to facts that didn't fit their preconceived notion. I think that's the point Todd's making.
Well, as we discussed, Jim, it's either incompetence or corruption. You take your pick. And you said in your letter to me, well, incompetence or corruption get you to the same place, except corruption, a conspiracy to corrupt is a crime, and you can be charged for it and disbarred for it as your lawyer. And incompetence, I don't think is a crime. I don't think it's a crime to be stupid. But that's the only two options here, all right? Because, you know, I got a call today from a person in Costa Rica, and they said that the university... some university in Costa Rica, and I'm going to get this paper, the document they wrote. They wrote, there's something wrong with this ruling because, first of all, it's written terribly. It's not written right. And the developers had all the permits. And there's something wrong with this, right? This is not, you know, this is a university writing this after reading it. But so... Well, look, let's go into talk to me about what I read your notice, and it says about serious, 68.2, serious irregularity grounds are a closed list, and the only remotely relevant grounds appear to be those you will see in 68.2. I wrote that. I read that. Let me ask you a question about this. It talks about... In 68.2c, failure by the tribunal to conduct the proceedings in accordance with the procedure agreed by the parties. And it also talks about let me ask you this. What were the rules of evidence in this hearing that we agreed to? Did we agree to the rule of evidence in this, or what's the rule of evidence? Are the arbitrators required to base their ruling on facts and evidence, or no?
There are no formal rules of evidence in arbitration.
All right. Well, I think they honor customary international law. Correct.
The arbitration itself is subject to English arbitration law. It's an unscheduled proceeding in London. So the English Arbitration Act does not impose upon it leaves them free to conduct the procedure according to what the parties have agreed.
I'm not talking about procedure. I'm talking about rules of evidence. Are they supposed to make decisions based upon evidence, factual evidence, or not?
Yeah, David, that's where the rules of evidence come from. Rules of evidence are not a feature of international law. There is no rule. There is no customary international law of evidence. Full stop.
All right, let me ask you a question, whatever at all. I know that in Costa Rica, there are rules of evidence similar to what we have that, you know, you have to, based on facts and evidence. You can have hearsay, you can have hearsay testimony. So what's the playing field there? I thought that's a playing field we were playing on, that facts and evidence were important in this case. Am I wrong?
You're not wrong in general terms, but as Jim said, there are no applicable rules of evidence per se. And so in England, just as in the US, we have rules of evidence applicable in the courts, but they would not apply to an arbitration. And so it's within the party's gift to agree the procedure, and the tribunal has to follow the agreed procedure, and they interpret that in a manner that is intended to deliver justice fairly and for them to act impartially as between the parties. So there's no specific, you will not find a rule that says the arbitrators cannot entertain hearsay evidence, for example.
Well, you know, I have an old saying that I've had to say for years, and I'm unfortunately having to say it again now. And that saying is, why am I hearing that now? I thought we were playing by the rules of just the normal rules of evidence, that you have to have facts and evidence. You can't have hearsay. You have to have witnesses making statements and testifying against you. And if that wasn't the case, I mean, I should have been told of that way before, right up front.
David, we discussed this with George a couple of years ago in the context of why there were no witnesses from Zatenna and why Mr. Bogantes couldn't be a witness and how we could compel witnesses. And I recall discussing the way evidence works in international arbitration with you and with George.
Well, you know what? Then Trump is right when he wants to get rid of these arbitration rules, because if that's the case, it's a joke. It's a joke. This whole thing's a big joke, because the arbitrators are like, they're like paragods, and they can do whatever they want to, and it's okay.
Just to be clear, it's not. It's sort of like you're talking past each other. What you're hearing isn't exactly what they're saying. For example, the idea that you can't find a fact without evidence is true. That's if someone does that, if someone finds facts and they're not based on evidence, that's a problem. That if they've done it enough, then that's a reason to seek annulment of the award. The difference with that is if there is evidence and they make the wrong decision based on the evidence. If they make the wrong decision based on the evidence, then they still fulfilled their duty, which was to make a decision of the facts based on evidence. They just got it wrong. So there's a difference between not having any evidence at all and nonetheless coming up with facts versus coming up with the facts even though you got the evidence wrong.
Well,
that's really what we're talking about here. They had the evidence. The problem is the conclusions they're drawing from it.
Well, the problem is they threw the facts and evidence out the window. They didn't listen. Zatenna had a law saying everyone must comply with Zatenna resolutions. That was a law, all right? And everyone included the arbitrators. They weren't excluded by that. They included prosecutors, judges, Giovardo, anybody. They had to comply with that. And the fact is they didn't. They didn't comply with Costa Rica law. Now, what's the duties of arbitrators to comply with the law? Are they required to comply with the law or not?
They are required to comply with the law that's applicable to the matter, but, and this is a really important but, being wrong about that law is not the ground to overturn the award.
Well, it's a matter for judicial practice, I think. The writer of those reports said, quoted this judge, this was very clear. He says, it's very important for our rulings to be accurate and correct because they affect people's lives. And they must be clearly stated so everybody understands what the ruling is, and even the losing party will understand why we decided what we decided, and it was just and fair. Now, let me ask you a question about that. All of you, you read the report. That report, that ruling, I don't even know who wrote that ruling. I could go down here, Stetson Law School in St. Petersburg, and get somebody out, a freshman in there, law class 101, that could do a better job of writing up that ruling to be more clear. That was a very unclear, confusing ruling. And I'm scratching my head about what do they mean? What are they trying to say here? They're darkened by their understanding. All this nonsense, all right, that you don't even know what they're talking about. So when you read, did you notice that when you were reading that ruling? How disjointed it was and how poorly written it was? They misspelled words. They repeated words. This is supposed to be the best of the best, and this is what they do. They produce a ruling you couldn't even understand and was riddled with mistakes. I mean, just grammatical mistakes.
The way I interpreted those, I think the award was written in Spanish, and I think it was translated into English, and I suspect it's a case of the translators having made a few typos and errors.
Well, you know what? I know somebody that speaks fluent Spanish, and I gave him that translation in Spanish, and I said, would you read this for me and give me an answer on this? And you know what they said? It's terrible in Spanish. So it's not that it was good in Spanish and it just got bad translation. It was written that way, poorly. So how do you account for that? It tells me that Baker had no input on that ruling. I don't even think Siqueiros could write that badly. So that only leaves it to Pedro Meekin, who was sleeping half the time. And it sounded like it was written by some lawyers in Monex down in Costa Rica, sent to the arbitrators, and they just published it. Because that was a terrible written ruling. Do you agree with that, Jim, or don't you? I mean, I've written judges' decisions before, and they're crisp and clear and bang, to the point you can understand them. This one, no. Is that right or wrong?
I'm trying to answer your question, David.
Go ahead.
I believe that this one is poorly written. I think there are logical gaps in here. I think that spelling mistakes are not basis on which you can challenge it. But
no, I'm not talking about challenging them on that, Jim. I'm talking about paying these guys $2 million to render that kind of a junk report and this kind of flawed ruling and bad law. I think is a little bit much, don't you? Over $2 million for that. What do I call it? This horrendous written ruling and terrible flawed reasoning and judgment?
If the question is whether I'm appalled by it, yes, I am.
Well, I think we all are. So, but, all right, look, give me your bottom line. I don't need to go through this. What's ironic, Jim? I insisted on this seat of the arbitration to be not in the United States because I was sure as anybody else were going to win, and I didn't want this to be challenged in some New York court or DC court where all the liberals would you know, throw the U.S. investors under the bus like they've done so many times before. And now, because we like UK because they generally support arbitration decisions, and now we're just in the reverse position here. So give me your thinking on this, because there's probably not much of a chance we're going to prevail in anything, is there?
Okay, well, I think it would be useful to hear everyone's view on this. I'll tell you mine. For me, it is a question of, how do I put this? It's essentially an expected value analysis. The chances of success of a challenge on any of the grounds that we mentioned under English law are small. They're not non-existent, but they are small. The amount of money that will be required to spend just to determine whether or not we win is very high, and it is very likely that the English court is going to say either you've got to pay what's due them if you want to bring the claim, or you've got to deposit the money in the court so that if you don't succeed, you pay the
claim. Yeah.
You've got to deposit money for their costs is pretty high. So that as an expected value proposition, this is robustly negative, and I don't think it's a wise investment of your money, and I know that my partners are going to tell me that it is not a wise investment of my money, and they're not going to authorize me to spend. We're already well over. I had to write off close to $3 million.
Mm-hmm.
That did not go well, and this is the month in which we get to read, as Louise will say, this is the month where we start redividing our equity for the next 2 years. So that did not help.
Mm-hmm.
Now, yes, George's account, but I don't see, as bad as it is and as outrageous as it is, I don't see that putting any more money on this is either plausible or reasonable. That's sort of where I am. And I hate it, but I don't know what else to say.
Well,
I'd like to hear what
I don't disagree with that, because Go ahead. What?
I agree completely with Jim, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean it's a business decision of throwing good money after bad, I guess, that you're faced with. In the bottom line, and like I said, your partners are not willing to. They would not willing to be to do that. Have you talked to Vannon about this at all? Have you talked to Yasmin over there about any of this? Have you spoken?
I have, David, and her views. I haven't had a lengthy discussion with her. She's in the middle of something quite significant at Vannon, but she is as disappointed as we are in the award.
Of course.
Understandably, but she, and her view as well, is that the likelihood of successfully bringing a challenge is very, very slim. I don't think there would be any appetite. I haven't asked, but I'd be very surprised if there would be any appetite on Vannon's part.
Well, you know what you may want to do? Louise, you may want to get that in writing, because you don't want them coming back and at you and say, oh, we wanted to do something and you didn't do it. So you better get that in writing, I would suggest.
That's a good point. We need to protect you. We're going to have to get them to agree not to pursue it.
Get them to agree they don't want to pursue it. I mean, you got to get them to write this off, just like you're going to write it off. Because if you don't, they could come back at you and say, hey, wait, we wanted to do something, and you didn't give us an opportunity to.
Guys, I have to get off the call. I've got to go upstairs for my.
Go. Go ahead. Okay, Todd. Good talking to you. Go ahead.
My point is, we need to tell them that before the deadline to challenge, so that they know you don't intend to do it, so that they can't later come back and say, hey, you should have done it. You with me?
When's the deadline?
We would have to file something hearing by Tuesday of next week.
Jeez. So it's not 3 months.
No, we can ask for an extension, but we'd have to actually give notice of a challenge even to do that. And
the extension, so the way it works in England is that the extension is in the court's discretion, and one of the factors that we take into account is whether they think the challenge has any merit. So I think there's a good chance that even an extension would be refused.
Okay, but, you know, what we could do is buy some time. Would the extension wouldn't put any funds up right now? It's just a document saying we'd like some more time to review this?
It's more than that.
The immediate problem with trying that is, in order to do that, you and the investors are going to have to submit yourself to the jurisdiction of the English court. What Costa Rica's lawyers will almost 100% certainly do in response to that is immediately make a counterclaim against you for the money that's set out in the award. And they're going to say the English court now has jurisdiction over you because you've come here and submitted yourself to the court. And what I'm very worried about is now you're stuck either litigating or getting a default judgment against you, which could then be brought to the United States to enforce.
All right, let me ask you this question. Not only did we lose, but then they had a tack on $1 million to cover Costa Rica's arbitration cost. What's the process of collecting that? And also, what's the situation? They could put a lien on the property or take the property. Is that right?
Yes. Yes,
they could. They'll be waiting for the 28-day period to expire, I would imagine, before they do anything to see if you do challenge. But once that 28-day period has expired, they will most likely be looking to enforce. And that, to me, would be the most obvious route.
Would that be immediate, or would there be some time lapse in that, or what?
Let me
ask this question. 28 days lapse. Do they have to get like they do in our courts, get a judgment, and then they try to collect on the judgment? Do the arbitrators have to sign something to finalize that, or what?
No. Costa Rica would just have to take the award to the Costa Rican authorities and just get it recognized and enforced, which is not a lengthy procedure.
So it would, a couple of weeks they could do something, act on it.
After the 28 days, yeah. So, I mean, that would be a question, I think, worthy of asking Bataya, really. They will have more on-the-ground knowledge of how that would work.
Yeah. All right, okay. Listen, one last thing. As you all know, I was very involved in this case with George, and there was various things that were done that were were against my entering that audio tape, that bribery tape. I told him again and again, put it in because it's going to make us look like liars, and he refused to do it. And what do? They come back and slam us for it. And basically said, you're lying, all right? And that's exactly what I said would happened, all right? Now, God knows what effect that had on the arbitrators, that little thing, oh. And they said, bribery is a serious crime, all right? And yet we had an audio tape with them asking for a bribe, and we didn't use it. And they come back and stick us with it, and who knows what would happen if they had that audio tape, what it may have changed their thinking about this whole case, all right? But you see how critical that was? that didn't get, and then and by night, but you know, see, and I argued with him, and he refused to listen to the client about that. That's
yeah.
one thing. Now, I don't need you to comment. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say two things about that. I noticed the reference in the award to the fact that the request for arbitration had mentioned an audio recording, and that, you know, we hadn't put one in. But from recollection, and I'll have to go back and check the request to be 100%, the reference to the audio recording in the request for arbitration that King and Spalding drafted was actually wrong. It referred to an audio recording of the Bergantes bribe, when actually what you had was an audio recording of the municipality attempted bribe.
Well,
that's one thing. And then the other thing was just that you'll remember when we listened to the audio recording, there was a risk if we put it in that it would have been interpreted against you. Because of the
I wasn't the one asking for a bribe. They were.
No, I know. But there was a criminal investigation, obviously, ongoing in respect of you. And the tire agreed that if the audio...
Hey, listen. Yeah. All right. But see, look, Louise, that was my call. It was if there's going to be ramifications or blowback, it would come to me. And I was willing to accept those risks to get that evidence in. So, you know, you're supposed to listen to your clients, I think. And on key issues like this, you know, that may have been a critical mistake not to mention that. But let me just final, you know, kind of, I just want to share this with you, all right? You know, and I could write a book, Jim and Louise, about all the letters and emails that I sent to all you guys, okay, all the whole legal team. And I was very much engaged in this. And I wrote an email to George on, November 16th or something. And it was like 20 pages of suggested cross-examination questions for Martinez. And it really revolved around this whole key issue that I've identified as being the problem. And not only did I suggest this for Martinez, I suggested, you know, and again, I tried to get from George a case strategy. I said, and you know, when you go to court, Jim, you have to have a case strategy. And you have to have what they call an order of proof, right? What order are you going to put in your evidence to prove up your case, correct? Is that right?
Yeah.
All right. So what was the relevant things we had? And I always said this, it boils down to the fact we had all the permits. And when I told George, I said, listen, you've just got to get the relevant documents in front of everybody and grill everybody on all the Satena, every Satena resolution you put in front of their face and ask them about it and comment about it. And all the reports, the inspection reports, put in front of their face, ask them about it. Ask them if they knew that it was the law that they had to comply with these Satena resolutions. And then why didn't they, you know? But to go to the main point, okay, to go to the main point that we were talking about, that I think you have identified, and God and all of you have identified as what they did here, in accepting this false narrative that I duped Satena, I concealed the wetlands, and therefore it was my responsibility that and I got the permits fraudulently, right? Well, listen, a couple of the questions I put in, just reviewing this, I told George to ask Martinez. Did anyone from Satena ever tell you Mr. Avon duped them into believing there was no wetlands on La Sola site? If so, who told you that, and what date was that? One question. Do you believe Mr. Avon duped Satena into issuing an EV permit? If he says no, fine, then we got him. If he says yes, then the follow-up question is, why did you believe that? And what evidence did you have? Did you believe that? Another thing is, did you, Mr. Martinez, Did you make that claim and charge in the criminal trial? No, it wasn't made. And although I said we need to put that in and stress that, again, not stressed, never stressed, and although I told the arbitrators, please go review the criminal trial records. That is not in there. That wasn't, they didn't claim that in there. And I said, did you allege that in your criminal accusation? Again, that's another question. Did was that alleged in your criminal accusation? I duped Satena. So questions like, was that manufactured by the respondent as a way to obviate the responsibility for illegally shutting down the project? Now, Jim, listen, this is not my first lawsuit. I've been in cases before. I know how trials go, all right? And I sent this, this is just a few sentences in 20 pages. It's all about this kind of stuff. And I sent them the documents, all right? Didn't ask one question. George spent most of his time asking questions that were, I said, what's the point of these questions? They don't go to the facts and evidence that we have on our side. And when you say the arbitrators bought into it, then I have to ask the question, well, why'd they buy into it? Because we weren't putting forth the evidence in a coherent manner. There was no coherence to this. It was like a shotgun. It was all over the place. I listened to George's cross-examination of the witnesses, and it was terrible. It was terrible because what I told him to stress with every witness, not only with Martinez, every one of them, Yawardo, every Costa Rica witness, ask them the same question. Show them the documents. Let them respond. Why? Because you know why? The arbitrators would hear it over and over and over and over again. And they would maybe get it. But when you don't say anything, Jim, when your case strategy is so all over the board where there's no coherency to it, there's no laser focus to it, then I'm not surprised we got a ruling like we did, because from my standpoint, this case was not prosecuted correctly, I'm telling you. And I'm just looking at the evidence here. And it wasn't laser focused. It wasn't sticking to the points that to clear up all these things that you said. And again, you concluded, well, they thought you had a duty to provide more things for Satena. They think you duped them. See, you kind of bought into that because, well, that's what they said, and we didn't refute it well enough, and we didn't have a focused case strategy of putting the evidence in front of every state witness and grilling them on it. You know, all the points of that, asking them about it. And what would that be for the arbitrators? Well, the arbitrators would hear the responses. We would be able to then follow up if they said something stupid or something wrong. We could hit them on it. But that never happened, see? And no matter, George was a good writer. He was a good writer. But the oral hearing is important because that tests the veracity of the witnesses, and words are more profound than written. The oral word is more profound and memorable than the written word, see? They stick in people's mind better. And by not having that laser-focused cross-examination of the key witnesses and all of these things, you can go back and read that. I sent it to you. And regrettably, it's just right on point with what we were talking about earlier about why we lost this case. And then I have to conclude with saying this. You know, you made an observation. You said there's not much difference between corruption and incompetence gets you the same place. Well, what was it? I mean, I could look back in this and I said, it was either incompetence or corruption with George too, because was he such an ill-prepared lawyer that he was not able to get his case together where he could really laser focus on the facts and evidence in this case? That was the heart of our case. The facts, we got all the legal permits. And the you know we could challenge them on the duping thing and on the Prodi thing, and you know, show them the Prodi report and say, okay, this is the Prodi report. I want you to point in the Prodi report where you where they say there's wetlands. Do that for me. Show me. All right. What would that do? It would show the arbitrators it doesn't say it. Dramatically demonstrate it to them. Things like that. And let them read from the report saying, no wetlands. No wetlands, you see. But the evidence wasn't advanced in a really organized, laser-like focus. In fact, you know, when George was cross-examining the, like me and our witnesses, I was really surprised at those questions because he was asking questions that didn't have any relevance, and they were kind of, I'm thinking to myself, what does he mean by that? Like, and a couple of people said, I heard him say, he was cross-examining, and said, I don't understand that question. Now, for a guy to say he doesn't understand a question coming from his lawyer, our lawyer, that he can't ask him, like, you know, throw the softball, no, easy, home run pitch, that you can't ask him some questions that will advance our case, but he have to ask these hard questions that don't really get us anywhere. I mean, it just ill-prepared us all along the way, I observed. And I was hoping that in light of that, the arbitrators, they had the evidence in front of them. They could see the evidence. But frankly, you know, corruption or incompetence on the arbitrator's part, I don't know. It's either one of the two. But this is a terrible ruling. We spent years of our lives in this, and wasted time, wasted effort, and it's horrendous. I feel sorry for the investors that put in $3 million in this case and they lost it. So I understand it's the end of the road, but it's more like going over the cliff here, not the end of the road. It's like end of the road is the cliff that you just drove over. So for us, it's a very devastating ruling, and you know, and then I wondered. I said, now what? You know, I thought about this. I said, now was it just accident that George quits a couple months after the case is over and is gone out of VE? He doesn't want to be around for the bomb blast that goes off. I said that's kind of curious. That he just leaves, he quits, you know, right after the case is over and leaves. So a lot of things don't add up to me. I mean, with George and, you know, I think he's a better lawyer than that. I don't know why he didn't demonstrate it in this case. So anyway, all right. I'll get this disseminated to the rest of the other U.S. investors and let them know.
We'll be able to send to Bannon for you to look at.
And then you better get that letter from Bannon, telling you that they don't want to pursue this and put any more money into it.
Okay. We'll do it.
And could you send me a copy of that letter too?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Hey, Louise, let me ask you a question. Did we get every Centeno resolution in English?
I think so, but it's been a while since I looked at the record. We certainly got the main one.
Yeah, I got one. Would you search that, and if you could get those, I'd just like to see them in English again, and if you give them to me, I'd appreciate it. But all right. Well, listen, and also try to get, you know, see if you can find out from, you know, give me a time, give me a date we can act on this. Because I'd like to maybe try to do something with that property before they confiscate it. I have a
okay. I mean,
a plan
really,
for that.
Yeah, I think really you ought to speak to Bataya about how quickly the award will be recognized and enforced in Costa Rica.
I will. Okay. All right. Okay. Thanks for calling. And if you need to talk with me further, give me a call.
Thanks, David.
Okay. So long, Jim. So long, Louise.
Bye.
Bye-bye.